At the university I attended, dancing was once forbidden. I know this might sound strange to some of you from places or cultures where dancing is just a normal part of life from birth to death, just something you do because you have a body, and when there's music around, it feels good to move. But for Norwegian Lutheran immigrants with a pietist bent in the early 1900s in the cold of northern Minnesota, dancing was not a part of everyday life. On the contrary, it was seen as a pathway to sin, if not inherently sinful itself. Everybody knows what happens, went the logic, when a bunch of young people start moving in time to the music. So from the university's founding, dancing was officially outlawed as part of student life. That doesn't mean it never happened behind closed doors, but for most of the school's first 100 years, there were no school-sponsored dances on campus. There were no dance classes, much less a dance department, which there actually is now. And there was certainly no dancing in church. So that might seem a pretty far cry from our church here, where we do dance in church sometimes, or where we try to anyway, in the space we have. But the truth is, Christianity has often had a deep, deep suspicion of the body. Whether it's outlawing dancing, or taking a heavy-handed approach to dress codes, or having an impossibly difficult time talking about human sexuality, when it comes to bodily stuff, Christians have been everything from squeamish to openly hostile. In one sense, this is incredibly strange. I mean, of all major world religions, Christianity gives the most exalted position to a single human body. Other religions speak of God using a variety of mythical images, or using language of spirit, or strongly insisting that God can never be represented in any physical way. But Christians actually say God was uniquely present in a human body, was made incarnate, literally was enfleshed. The big news of the Christian faith is that in a single, fragile human life, all the glory of God was pleased to dwell, full of grace and truth. So with that claim at the center, you would think that Christians would hold the body in the highest esteem, would be comfortable with it, would honor it, because, well, God honored it in the highest possible way. So on the one hand, it is incredibly strange that Christians would be suspicious of the body. But on the other hand, how could we be anything else with a passage like the one we have from Paul's letter to the Romans today? For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. To set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. So it's all right there, right? Spirit equals life and peace, flesh equals death. Good things come through spiritual means, bad things come through bodily. So honor the spirit and suppress the body. No dancing, right? That is definitely how this language has sounded to Christians over the centuries, and it's worked its way deep into our psyche. So much so that Christianity has often been this religion made of flesh and blood human beings, people with bodies, making the wild claim that God took on a body, and yet burdened with this idea that bodies are a bad thing, and the goal is to live as basically disembodied spirits. It's really strange, right? The good news is that Paul is not actually a body-hating ascetic, but he is speaking in ways that we need a little bit of help to understand. In the chapters of Romans that come before our reading today, Paul has been speaking loud and clear about the identity of his hearers. You belong to the family of Christ, he's told them. Christ gets the final say in your life, not sin and death. They have no dominion over you. You have died to their power. All that is true, he says to them and to us. You are dead to sin and alive to Christ. And you are still alive in this world. So how will you live tomorrow? In answer to that question of how we will live given our identity in Christ, Paul brings in these two big words, flesh and spirit. There's no question about which sort of living, he says, is appropriate to one who belongs to Christ. Here's where we jump to that whole body bad, spirit good train. But that's not really what Paul means to say. For Paul and for his contemporaries in the ancient world, flesh was basically about temporary things. Things that are corruptible, that pass away, as flesh does in the normal course of things. It doesn't mean that flesh is bad, but that it's temporary. It's limited. It's far from eternal. And Paul is concerned that we not live according to the flesh, that we not set our minds on the flesh. To live that way is to operate as though there's nothing to be concerned about beyond my limited wants and desires that come and go. And Paul's convinced that there is more to life than that. We are bodies, yes, but we are bodies animated with God's Spirit. We are capable as living as more than a walking embodiment of I want, I want, I want. In these very bodies, we can live with our minds set on something greater than my individual wishes at any moment. We can live with our minds on the purposes of God that include us, but are not limited to us. In Paul's language, we can set our minds on the Spirit. So I know all of this sounds just terribly abstract. That's part of what makes Paul's writing challenging. So let me try this example. Lots of you have heard me talk about taking young people camping in the wilderness before. I spent a couple of summers doing this in the Rocky Mountains in the western United States when I was a university student. And I come back to those summers often, particularly to the meal times. At the camp where I worked, we took these groups of high school students out on 5-day, 4-night backpacking trips with all our meals loaded in our packs. Dinner usually consisted of a big pot of something, usually rice or pasta with this pack of powder mixed in that you never could quite get mixed. If you've done some wilderness camping before, you know that the food quality is easily overlooked. What's important is that it is hot, and it's there, and it will satisfy your hunger. So after I'd taken a few of these groups out on wilderness trips, I began to discover a pattern when it came to mealtimes. On the first night out, we would prepare this pot of carbs du jour, and when we sat the group down in a circle with the meal at the center, it was all we leaders could do to keep it from turning into sort of a free-for-all. Hunger was definitely the boss. There's one pot, and there's all these people here, and I need to get as much as I can and quickly eat it up so I can get my seconds, was sort of the inner logic of each person. The scene was a little bit alarming at first, but as I said, a pattern emerged after you saw this a few times, and you began to know what to expect. The second night wasn't much different. Still all this hurried eating and fighting for seconds and anxiously checking how much others had to be sure they didn't have more than you. It was around the third night that something began to change. Maybe it was knowing that this whole thing was soon over. More likely, I think it came from having shared a few meals together and seeing that this all did work out. Whatever the reason, the mealtime became less frantic. It wasn't this gathering of nervous, desperate individuals anymore, but a communal table where everybody knew there was going to be enough to go around. There was less pushing, less jockeying for who was going to be fed first and most. Sometimes we leaders, by this point, sometimes, would even see the kids offering some to each other, being sure people got seconds who wanted it. It was the same setting every night, the same campfire. But there were two very different ways to inhabit that one scene. Paul's terminology works pretty well, I think. On the first nights, the group's mind was set on the flesh. On the later nights, their minds were set on the Spirit. It has nothing to do with bodies being bad. It's a gift to go hiking with others and to sit down at a common table and to share a meal. Bodies make it possible to do those things. It's how we inhabit them that makes the difference. If we set our immediate wants and drives ahead of everyone else's, or if we allow God's priorities of wholeness and justice and love to realign us through and through, body, mind, and spirit. So, of course, we're not out in the wilderness around a campfire most of the time, but we are around the campfires of our families or our friends. We are around the campfire of our church community here. We are around the larger campfire of Christians throughout the world. And we are around the campfire of our common shared humanity, where all these centuries after Paul, life is still so easily focused on the fulfillment of passing desires, on getting what I want when I want it, where it's easy to fall prey to the illusion that there's not enough to go around, and my only choice is to grab as much for myself as I can get. And we know where this way of living leads us, to nations in conflict, to an earth stretched at the seams, to people profoundly isolated from one another in their own private worlds of me first, and to those most vulnerable left behind. When Paul says that to set the mind on the flesh is death, I think this is precisely what he means. There is no real life in living captive to my every passing desire. There is no life there for me or for the world. But there is another way, Paul says. To set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. To live with a mind set on the wider purposes of God. To realize that the Spirit of God dwells in you and in others around you just the same. To know that the Spirit is there, flickering around the campfire, and there is more than enough to go around. This mindset, this awareness, which we find through prayer, through quiet, through worshiping together, through sharing together around the table, this is meant to transform everything, mind and body and spirit, and the way that we move as whole persons through the world. Bodies are a good thing. The God of the Incarnation certainly thinks so. And we find life for them, life that is full and free and enduring, when we remember that they are dwelling places of the Spirit, when we glimpse that we are not only what we want, but also what we can offer for the sake of the world. Friends, that is good news. It's cause for dance and for song. Amen.